Hello, on this week's program, a conversation about the role of the arts in Philadelphia's public school system. We speak with three advocates working to make art and music part of every public school child's experience. Philadelphia Inquirer music critic David Patrick Stearns on Leonard Bernstein's Third Symphony, The Kaddish. It's now being performed by the Philadelphia Orchestra with a new text written and narrated by Holocaust survivor Samuel Pisar. And as the political climate heats up, Jason Pfeiffer reports on a Mum Puppet Theatre production of George Orwell's classic novel, Animal Farm. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
There's much talk these days about improving the quality of arts education for children. Over the past three decades, various factors have contributed to a deterioration in the quality and quantity of what youngsters learn. Tighter budgets, a scarcity of qualified teachers, and pressure to spend more time on the so-called core subjects, reading, writing, and math. The No Child Left Behind Act has placed further pressure on schools to demonstrate progress in these areas through better test scores. It wasn't always so. In the 1970s, arts and music were an integral part of the Philadelphia public school system. There were art teachers in every school, and almost all middle and high schools had a band or orchestra. Today, arts and music are low on a list of priorities for a school district plagued with financial problems, high truancy rates, and student violence. Yet city officials say there is hope. The district currently spends more on arts education than many larger cities, like Los Angeles, and the School Reform Commission's budget for next year proposes an increase of more than $15 million for arts and music, and all this in a state that is among the worst in the nation for per capita spending on public education. To discuss these issues, we invited three people who are now grappling with the challenge of improving arts education for Philadelphia public school students. Pearl Schaefer is Executive Director of the Philadelphia Arts and Education Partnership, a local organization that encourages, promotes, and facilitates arts education programs. Gretchen Everson, the Picasso Project Coordinator for Public Citizens for Children and Youth, a regional children's advocacy group, and the publisher of the recent study Portrait of Arts and Education in Our Public Schools, and Dennis Creedon, the Administrator of Creative and Performing Arts for the School District of Philadelphia. He oversees over 400 arts and music teachers in 267 schools, serving 167,000 children.
Children are Picasso at the age of five, and they have advanced skills in the arts. It's just a question as to whether or not we understand what the skills are doing for the development of the brain, as well as then the social context of how it helps children make meaning and make relationships. But more importantly, I think the arts also feed us on a social level and a cognitive level in the sense of our well-being as social animals. And it's a communicative method that we all use and gravitate towards. The other thing that's important about the arts is it teaches not only creative problem solving, but it has been shown in music education to build the cortex of the brain. And lastly, when we are in the process of creating the arts or even athletic engagement, we are producing peptides in the brain called endorphins, which directly counteract the peptide cortisol, which prevents us from learning. And if you are in a hyper-violent or stressed neighborhood or environment, it is very important that children have that cortisol mitigated. And it's even been proven in research in 1999 that just 23 minutes of listening to music reduces cortisol in the bloodstream. So it's important for us to look at not just the arts for the sake of research and development potentials in the future or the creative problem solving we need for the 21st century economy, but also what it does for us as human beings, as social animals.
Therefore, and I'm looking at you, Pearl Schaefer, why aren't we throwing vast quantities of money at all forms of arts education? Why isn't the federal government on board fully with the idea that this is equally as important as language skills, as reading and writing, as the sciences?
Well, I think traditionally we have looked at the arts as peripheral to core curricula. But I'd like to tag on to what Dennis just said, because all of the current brain-based research is now showing that we learn, retain, and retrieve information better when it is brought into the brain through multiple pathways. And all of the research today is showing that when students are engaged in any of the arts, whether they be visual or performing arts, the entire brain is lighting up, which indicates that this is the key to how we make inroads into learning in literacy, whether it be math or English or science or social studies. So I think we haven't had the hard data. We've had a lot of very interesting anecdotal information, but now I think we're at the cusp of really making a push for the arts, moving into and claiming their rightful place as a core curricular subject area.
Gretchen Everson, if we look back at the 70s, and people who remember that time will remember Philadelphia as being a bastion of great arts education. Every high school had a marching band. We had arts teachers. We had music teachers. Your organization has recently produced a report telling us what the current state of the city is. Can you give us a brief overview of, well, how bad or maybe even how good is it?
From what we learned, both from the school district and from Pennsylvania Alliance for Arts Education, is that about half of Philadelphia's district students don't have access to arts education. And that is a crisis. We're talking about an equity issue here. We're talking about a waste of potential talent, not only in the arts for students in the district, but potential for development in all of the areas that benefit from art study and the creative problem-solving, open-ended learning that both Dennis and Pearl just mentioned. So we are seeing a crisis point when we're looking back at the 70s, the 60s, the 50s, when people who went to West Philly High actually had gigs at night, went to 52nd Street, played, were able to serve their community musically, were able to also live out their potential in the schools.
Pearl, some people would say that arts education, and particularly the people that you're in partnership with, have got an ulterior motive, that they're trying to create audiences of the future.
Yes, we need audiences. And if we give students an opportunity to learn in and through the arts, then they will feel comfortable buying tickets to go to the orchestra. They will feel as comfortable going to a dance performance as they do to a sporting event.
Dennis Creedon, I can see that you want to get in on this point.
The arts give us a whole synergy of not only emotional conscious connectiveness, but also a sense of resilience and self-belief, a hope. The arts birth hope in the human consciousness. When we create art, we ponder the potential of what we can become and what our dreams are going to hold. If you want a child to not be involved in crime, the Governors Association has pointed out that the most effective treatment to prevent a repeat offense is a sequential arts program. The reality is that children need the arts because if they are involved in crime, it's usually because of some issue within their sense of self where they do not feel valued or they are rebelling. The arts, however, feeds our sense of self and actually heals us. That's why we have so many different forms of arts therapy, from bibliotherapy to dance therapy to poetic therapy. All of these therapeutic engagements we give children when they're ill or when they're incarcerated. We should think of the fact that our children deserve to have this as a natural part of their learning environment. The more we have arts in our life, the more we build not only self-confidence, but we build our own sense of wonder as to what we can become and what we can contribute to the community. And when we build audiences, we're building our local economy, because the National Governors Association pointed out that if we do not have the arts in the urban context, we will not have tourism and convention industry. And that is what many urban centers have become since we're no longer the industrial hubs of our economy. They are the places of our ancestry, our legacy, our history. And that is what people come back to reconnect with from suburbia or from other parts of the country. We do need to build audiences. But at the same time, we need to build ourselves. We don't forget the day we were in the play. But I'm sure a lot of children will want to forget the day they have to take the PSSA exams.
Gretchen.
Yeah, Jim, if I may, I think it might help the listeners if we break this down a little bit to get at this question of elitism. There's one school right now, Feltonville Intermediate, where all of us in this room are partners at the moment supporting arts in their school. The district, Dennis just spoke about a drumming program he's instituting.
Arabic drumming.
Pearl with Philadelphia Arts Education Partnership and the Picasso Project are supporting work with Spiral Q Community Puppet Theater as a resident artist, supplying teaching artists to support teachers working with kids, making life-size puppets based on ideas, conflicts, and issues that they and their families and their communities are having at the present. these kids are doing a project that's really related to their life. The ideas are coming from them in terms of the creative context. And this is not something that is composed somewhere in Europe and brought down through a curriculum mandate into the classrooms.
What's it going to take to convince our political leaders, to convince our citizenry of what you're talking about? If everybody believed, as all of you do, that this is central to the development of the child, we wouldn't be having a conversation about how there isn't the same funding now that there was 30 years ago in Philadelphia, because we would have that belief and it would be from the ground up.
I think part of figuring out that equation is having the appropriate data. That's where the research and the assessment comes in. And we're currently working on a project with the U.S. Department of Education through the School District of Philadelphia, where we're looking at how the arts impact students' lives as opposed to those students who do not have that experience with the arts, so that we have a quasi-experimental design project going on. But what we're doing is infusing the 4th, 5th, and 6th grade classrooms at 5 schools with arts-integrated learning experiences, particularly linked to literacy, so that we're looking at the skill sets across the arts and how they apply to the same skill sets we need when we're writing a sentence, building a paragraph, writing the essay. So this is what we're testing out. Once we have this kind of data, then it's scientifically, really, it's there. It will prove, it will be part of this group of proof. We also have the anecdotes, but I think some of this hard data is what's necessary.
And if I could add in, when we think of the sciences, and I think one of the problems that we have is that our educational systems have become so siloed. Everyone is specializing to such a degree that right now you have what is called in medicine an integrationist, which helps one form of medicine or doctor's teams to speak to another set because they do not know each other's fields. The same thing has happened within our own sense of history. When we think of Robert Fulton, we think steamship. But we don't realize is that he was studying under Benjamin West in London in fine painting when he saw his first power loom. Because of the research he had done in painting, and because painting is a scientific process of hypothesis, experimentation, redesign, re-execution, he immediately jumped from seeing the power loom to other uses. The same thing when we think of Morse code, we think, oh, yeah, Samuel Morse, he created Morse code. We don't think that if we go to the Cochrane Gallery in Washington, D.C., and you go to the second floor, you will see a huge portrait of the U.S. Capitol that is absolutely sublime. And who is the painter? The same inventor. When we have the arts, we build our own inventive capacity to problem solve and to see things in an interrelated way. Everyone comes out of a culture. Everyone comes out of a collective community that celebrates its identity and its wealth of culture. We need to make sure that every child has that wealth because that social capital, as it's called, enables us not only to climb the ladder of life, it also enables us to climb the ladder of hope. We can achieve and become whatever we allow our children to dream, but we have to feed the dream, and we feed the dreams of children through the arts.
Dennis Creedon, the Administrator of Creative and Performing Arts for the School District of Philadelphia. We also heard from Gretchen Everson of Public Citizens for Children and Youth, and Pearl Schaefer, the Executive Director of the Philadelphia Arts and Education Partnership.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Lord God of hosts, I call you to account. And don't shrug me off as if I were playing defiant daughter, your impudent rebel who could do with a slap. You know who I am.
Who hasn't been angry at God at some time? Leonard Bernstein's anger took on symphonic proportions in the midst of the 1960s Cold War, when the power of annihilation, once exclusive to God, came into the hands of man. The result was his Symphony No. 3, subtitled Kaddish, for narrator, chorus and orchestra. The public wasn't exactly looking to hear about all that then, but now, Bernstein's biggest and most neglected symphony is having a new life, thanks to Holocaust survivor Samuel Pisar. With the encouragement of the composer in his final years, and the blessing of the Bernstein estate, he rewrote the narration and made the Kaddish Symphony his own story. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns spoke to the principal figures in tomorrow's final Philadelphia Orchestra performance of the Kaddish, and adds his own personal memories of conversations with the composer.
Late into the night, Samuel Pizar talked about his decision to rewrite and narrate Leonard Bernstein's Kaddish Symphony. We were in a borrowed hotel lounge and on long borrowed time, since by all odds, Pizar shouldn't have lived beyond 16, his age when Allied troops liberated him from a Nazi death camp. He had seen his entire family die. Going on to become an international lawyer, the Paris-based Pizar initially resisted Bernstein's suggestion, made some 20 years ago, to take on this troubled symphony. Only after the tragedy of 9/11 did he reconsider, and then the real work began, finally coming to terms with a God who appeared to have abandoned him at Auschwitz.
I realized that I had to do some very serious thinking about my relationship with the Almighty. Of course, I had never abandoned him, but I had to get out of my system my anger, my disappointment, and my bewilderment as to why he was not there when events of this kind were going on. And as a young kid, while it was happening to me, I was very angry. All of that was working itself out as I was writing this, what would you call it, symphonic poem or oratorio or whatever it was.
Previous narrations, starting with Bernstein's wife, the accomplished actress Felicia Montalegre, had been theatrical, perhaps to a fault.
This time you show me nothing at all.
As a lawyer, author, and advisor to Steven Spielberg for the film Schindler's List, Samuel Pizar is no stranger to addressing large audiences and powerful people. But it's his unaffected real-person delivery for the Kaddish Symphony that makes the piece, well, something it never was before.
Lord, today I reach out to you with the same visceral voice and the same clenched fist I once raised against heaven blasphemously as a skeletal kid with shaved head and hollow eyes, trembling at the threshold of a Birkenau gas chamber, trembling and demanding to know, why have you abandoned us? How can you permit such carnage? Do you even care?
Philadelphia Orchestra's guest conductor John Axelrod, who led Pizar's first appearance in the symphony in 2003, informally studied the music with Bernstein himself, and feels that the gravity of the words now equals the magnitude of the music.
You hear the power and energy of Sam's story alongside the power and authenticity of Bernstein's music. And from that, I feel we have finally reached a balance for this work where the words and the music meet as one.
The symphony's most beautiful music is assigned to soprano solo, and it's these passages of the Kaddish Symphony that were never questioned. Sung here by Carita Matua, this was among the pieces sung after Bernstein's death at his memorial service in Carnegie Hall. With this new narration, soprano Kelly Nassif, who sings this week's Philadelphia Orchestra performances and was on hand for the premiere of Pizar's version, says her understanding of the music has deepened.
Right before I have to sing my solo, he talks about his grandmother and her teaching him prayers and to trust God, and then it was overwhelmingly emotional for me. And now I'm placed as the voice of his grandmother, whereas before it was just a voice, and now it is so intensely personal to him, and you feel that you want to be able to deliver that. You want to be able to give yourself over to her voice, to be able to display her love and her passion and her devout nature to God, and you try to let that come in.
Few knew that, at the end of his life, Bernstein was conceptualizing a magnum opus opera that was to be about the Holocaust. Few details were known even among his family members. I once asked Bernstein point blank, "How's your Holocaust opera coming along? That is what it's about, isn't it?" He replied in a low, uninflected voice, "That's part of it." One problem was a lack of librettist. Another was that Samuel Pizar had advised him not to do it. His argument was simple.
I always had this image of what was that great opera singer, Renata Tebaldi, who was corpulent Italian, and the image of her emoting in front of a gas chamber was a little more than I could accept. I don't know if he was going to do the Holocaust opera or if he had abandoned it, but his health was declining, and it may be that this is what pushed him to put the project of the opera to me, even though he was not satisfied with his own text.
Is it possible that the Holocaust opera that Bernstein longed to write had, in fact, been written already? By Bernstein himself during some of his best compositional years, and was only waiting for the right words to make it real? It does seem that, in this current form, the Kaddish Symphony has finally become what it was always meant to be.
Philadelphia Inquirer music critic David Patrick Stearns. The Philadelphia Orchestra's final performance of Leonard Bernstein's Kaddish Symphony is tomorrow afternoon at 3 at Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall. George Orwell's classic novel Animal Farm is among the most iconic books of the 20th century. Translated into dozens of languages with millions of copies sold throughout the world, the allegorical satire offers a critique of repressive government systems and those who empower them. This week, the Mum Puppet Theatre in Philadelphia opens a new stage adaptation of the classic tale. As WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, using puppets and human actors, the production mirrors both the past and the present.
The idea for the Mum Puppet Theatre to adapt and produce Animal Farm was sparked by a series of frustrating airport experiences. A few years ago, the Mum Puppet Theatre's artistic director, Robert Smythe, had to make numerous emergency plane trips, and with each trip, he was repeatedly pulled aside and searched, often in front of his fellow passengers.
And they'd look at me like, with just a look of, oh, thank God, they caught him. And I'd be standing there knowing that I was perfectly innocent, but it just had that idea of, and I think this is something American, which is, we don't expect to be stopped for anything. We have a free right to travel, and we're all equal. But when all of a sudden you realize you're in a situation where other people are enjoying liberty and you're not, immediately it crept into my head, oh, we're all equal except some are more equal than others.
Smythe's passing thought is a derivative of the rather famous Animal Farm line, all animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others. Smythe says after the phrase came to mind, the memory of Orwell's story and the inspiration to produce an adaptation of it soon followed. The 1945 book centers on a group of farm animals who overthrow their human owner, Mr. Jones, and set up a new egalitarian society. The fable involves the inspirational elder pig, Old Major, the visionary, Snowball, the tyrannical boar, Napoleon, and Boxer, the ever-hardworking horse. Animal Farm is, in large part, a commentary on the totalitarian regimes that Orwell observed around him. There are strong parallels in the story with the Russian Revolution and the early days of the Soviet Union under Stalin. But Orwell's experiences as a soldier in the Spanish Civil War were especially formative. The Mum Theater's Animal Farm adapter and playwright Andrew Perialli says as Orwell watched Franco's fascist regime come to power in Spain, the seeds for Animal Farm were being planted.
He really saw how propaganda was able to completely change black to white. Knowing that background really gives you a good idea of what he's talking about in Animal Farm.
But in the view of Perialli and director Robert Smythe, Animal Farm isn't just a creative history lesson. Smythe says there's a reason the book is still being talked about today.
I think what makes it enduring is the fact that the things that led to the situation depicted in Animal Farm are around us all the time.
Smythe says even the most well-intentioned government systems around the world often fall prey to those who are trying to gain or protect power. Information is manipulated. Personal freedoms are taken away. Andrew Perialli says Orwell makes it clear that this sort of deterioration doesn't happen overnight.
They start out for very idealistic reasons, and then someone with an agenda starts pecking away at it piece by piece in the name of security and happiness and the common good. And before you know it, you're in an authoritarian state that's even worse than what it originally replaced.
Creation of the Mom Puppet Theater's Animal Farm didn't happen overnight either. It's been a nearly two-year off-and-on development process with an ensemble of six actors. The luxury of having this much creative time is not normal for the Mom Puppet Theater, or most any theater for that matter. But a Philadelphia Theater Initiative grant helped fund the lengthy gestation period. Although the group read the book out loud together on the first day of development, the making of the Mom Puppet Theater's Animal Farm didn't really start with the text. Instead, the ensemble used much of the time to explore the main themes of the story through improvisations and collective brainstorming. With the material they developed, including songs, they built their own story around the major events in Orwell's fable.
Proof, comrades! Scientific proof in the most emphatic terms. You are working shorter hours for more food than in Jones's day. All hail Napoleon!
Rob Nedoff explains that like any adaptation, not everything from the book can be depicted on stage.
Because, I mean, you can make this thing 4 hours long if you wanted to, but as a group, we really collectively just kind of found what the really essence of the story was.
In telling the story, the Mom Puppet Theater production features both human actors and puppets. And in the view of the ensemble, the use of puppets in the production lends itself well to the subject matter. It is, after all, mainly a story about barnyard animals. Cast member Bernard Bygott says the use of puppets highlights the metaphorical nature of the piece, helping the audience to think about the story's underlying political and social ideas in a different light.
Which I think plays into why we're doing Animal Farm, why it can have all these different meanings.
Even so, the Mom Puppet Theater's Animal Farm is not merely a puppet show, according to Robert Smythe. He says alongside actors, there are actually only a handful of puppets used in the piece.
This is not a theater that is interested in puppets for puppet's sake. What puppets give audiences is the chance to imagine. And what a lot of theater does is kind of take imagination away. Because there's just a lot of, let me tell you, a lot of theaters just become very, very talky. But there is nothing like being in a room with a bunch of people who are going to tell you a really good story, but they're not going to tell it to you. They're going to show it to you, and they're going to sing it, and they're actually going to make you part of it.
And through the cautionary Animal Farm story, George Orwell surely was interested in having his readers imagine and question through the experiences of the farm animals how equality in societies and political systems can slowly erode. It's been over 60 years since George Orwell wrote Animal Farm. World War II was coming to a close and the Cold War was just beginning. But while the world's political landscape has changed, the Mom Puppet Theater is suggesting that the potential for humans to abuse power, manipulate information, and passively accept injustices remains today.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. Animal Farm is at the Mom Puppet Theater in Old City, Philadelphia through May 10th. And that's it for now. Our program this week was written by Susan Lewis, Zavit Schlanka, myself. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.